You're listening to Episode 9 of Season 5 of The Bad Apples. Hi everyone, this is Kratu, and this is my show. I released this in Aug and Speaks only, so if you're here poking around the site looking for an MP3 or an AAC or an M4A file or any other format, WMA, whatever, you're not going to find it. It is Aug and Speaks only, so obviously if you're hearing my voice, you've at least found out how to play Aug and Speaks or Speaks. And so this is a podcast about Linux and the GNU operating system and all kinds of interesting things like that. Namely, in this episode, I'm going to be talking about live CDs. What are they? Well, I'm going to assume that we all know what they are, but I'm going to talk about the different ones that I've tried lately under some fairly rigorous circumstances, rigorous testing. So I'll be talking about that. I'm going to talk about remapping your control key and your caps lock key, and I'm also going to be talking about MAMO, MIGO, Moblin, and MER. I'm going to be talking about Gatorius, and that's about it. So maybe some listener feedback. So let's just get started. Okay, first thing I want to tackle, I think, I'm going to try to keep it fairly brief, is the whole live CD thing. And live CDs are cool, and they're great, and I know that we've probably all tried them, so I'm not going to sit around trying to talk about details of live CDs. But lately, I've been using a lot of live CDs, mainly because I've had a job on the weekends where I'm completely alone at the job, and there's a computer off in the corner, and I decided that I really should be able to use that computer. Now, it was running Windows 2000. Yeah, Windows Server 2000 is what it was running, and I wasn't going to use that for sure, so I decided that I was going to try some live CDs. So this was kind of live CD usage that you read about. You know, this is like 12 hours a day for 2 days in a row for multiple, you know, every weekend for about 3.5 months I was using live CDs on this computer. So I tried a couple of different ones, and I kind of started to see a pattern emerge, or a classification scheme emerge. And the three broad categories that I sort of saw in the live CD market were, first of all, there were the lightweight ones, where, you know, maybe it's an older computer, or maybe it's a computer that you just want things to work really fast on, and since you're on a live CD, that's kind of hard to get the speed up to normal speed, so keeping the footprint of the overall operating system and everything potentially even small enough to load into the RAM of the computer is kind of an interesting idea, and it's one way to keep a quick pace on your computer, stuff like that. Another category that I noticed was the full desktop experience, meaning it was the kind of desktop that you'd expect if you'd gone over to someone's house and just said, hey, can I use your computer for a minute? You know, it's got all the applications installed that you would typically find on an everyday normal computer, like, you know, an office program, photo programs, different browsers to choose from, torrent software, a terminal, just everything like that. You know, just no matter what you are going to do, as long as it's within the typical realm of computer usage, you're probably going to find it on this live CD. And that's a great little environment, and I'll talk about some of the ones that I've used that were like that. And then the third one, the final one, that I noticed were the kind of specialized distributions, meaning maybe they're specially purposed toward security, you know, penetration testing, things like that. Or maybe they're specifically geared toward, obviously, like we all know about the multimedia ones, you know, the studios, the studio distros, and different things like that. So within the first category, the lightweight ones, the ones that I really, really tried you know, again, just really, really rigorously, just using it all day for all kinds of different tasks that might come to mind. Just whatever, you know. I mean, you have free time. You sit down at a computer. What are you going to work on? Who knows what you're going to work on? Maybe you're going to go surf the net. Maybe you're going to do some web development. Maybe you're going to write a letter or whatever you do in an office application. Maybe you're going to do some graphics, whip some graphics up for a site. Maybe you're going to try to edit some audio. All that other good stuff. So these live CDs that I tried each had, basically, I feel like all the live CDs that I tried were, at least among the lightweight ones and the full desktop experience ones, were very well planned out, actually. They all had applications for all those typical kinds of activities, whether they were a very lightweight office program like Abbey Word or something fully featured like OpenOffice. Doesn't really matter. The point is that if you need to get something within that category of work done, then you've got something to do that on. So the ones that I did try were Woolvix, which is the Slackware-based distribution, and I'd actually tried that already on my triple EPC. I had it on the SD card for quite some time, so I would boot into that just on occasion, just whenever I needed a Fluxbox fix or just wanted to try something different, you know, whatever. So I was kind of used to Woolvix and the way it was doing things. I didn't know about Woolvix was that it actually offered you lots of different desktop options on the boot, the login screen. I'd always just logged into Fluxbox, actually, but trying the open the live CD, I finally realized that they actually gave you a choice, and they have, like, OpenBox, Fluxbox, and I think, I want to say LXDE all on that disk, so you can try any of those environments, and they're all quite nice, actually. The other lightweight one that I tried a little bit was Slax, which, if you haven't tried that in a while, you need to revisit it. Their site is phenomenal. It's really come a long way since I last looked at them, which was probably about a year ago, really looking at them. And I'd seen that they were starting to do sort of an interactive website kind of thing where you can actually build your own version of Slax with lots of different Slax modules ready to use once you boot. But now they've got, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's almost like Suse Studio, I think. You know, I mean, if you think about that, you can just kind of like, you can go there, you can find a module for just nearly anything and check that for your install. And at the end of it, you get an ISO with all the modules that you want available to be run within Slax. So that was really cool. And ideally, I would have spent some time, some focused time trying to build my own Slax distro that had all the things that I really wanted on it, and only the things that I really wanted on it. Realistically, though, I would go there and get so overwhelmed by all the choices that I would end up not actually completing anything. So, but it is neat. It is very cool. And if I was still at the job that I had on the weekends, I've since left. But if I was still there, I would definitely get a custom Slax thing now that I know exactly what I need. One thing that, of course, no live CD ever had was Audacity, and I would always end up needing Audacity. Just, and I should know this already. I mean, I do so many podcasts, you figure I'm going to require Audacity at some point. So I think custom Slax with Audacity on there would have been really something to consider. In terms of the full desktop experience distributions, live CDs, I tried a couple of different ones. I tried PC Linux OS, which I've actually tried before. It was the same version that I tried here on this show. I tried it just for a little while, but I tried it for a lot more at this job, and I will say that it's just really, really nice. It is set up really nicely. It feels very comfortable. It's KDE 3.5 point something, really nicely set up with fake transparency and stuff like that. It looks nice, and it is nice. It's got everything you could ever need out of it. I really never felt like I was missing anything out of PC Linux OS. Another one I tried was Suse, which I'd never really tried all that much before. I'd tried it like way back when I was really, really distro hopping, trying to find something that would just work on a computer because, you know, I didn't know anything back then. And I had the Slackware partition that I started on, but then I needed something to actually get work done in since I didn't know what I was doing on Slackware yet. So, you know, I needed that other partition of a productive kind of Linux distribution. And I did try Suse back then, and I didn't keep it installed, which I guess says something. I don't really know why. I don't remember why I didn't keep it installed, but I remember being impressed with it, and now I'm still impressed with it. It is a nice distribution. It looks really professional. It's got that look and feel to it, and I don't know quite what it is. Maybe it's just the knowledge that, yes, they are in the enterprise Linux market, and so there's this preconceived notion that they're going to look and feel very professional. But they do look and feel very professional, and from what I could tell. It's a very smooth boot process. There's branding all over the place. They've got a very consistent look to them. It felt fairly polished, I guess. I mean, it didn't feel any more polished, I guess, than PC Linux OS, but I don't know, I guess partly because it was KDE 4, but also because they've got a really nice, you know, rather than just some boot pictures that some hacker somewhere kind of hacked together in GIMP versus, you know, the really, really nice professional-looking branding of OpenSUSE. I guess there's a big difference there, too. Whether I would use PC Linux OS versus Seuss or vice versa. You know, I mean, if I had the choice, I mean, honestly, they're about equal. They both seemed to do the same thing, so I wouldn't say that there's a big advantage to Seuss or anything like that. I'm just saying that it looked a little bit more professional. But the cool thing was when I noticed, you know, when I tried Seuss, well, first of all, one cool thing was their little zipper tool that they've got now, ZYPPER, I think. It's kind of like Yum or Aptitude. So it's a front end, I think, to a front end to a packaging system or something like that. Point is, it's really nice, actually. It's what you would expect from a modern Linux distribution with a command line process of installing packages. I don't know what they had before. I don't know if there was like a YAST command or something on the command line or what exactly they used, but Zipper was easy to figure out. It was easy to use, and it worked fairly, I guess, quick enough for me. I didn't have any problem with it, so I guess that I guess it works. The other thing that I noticed was that a lot of these distributions, like these professional looking distributions like Red Hat or Seuss, well, even honestly Fedora and even Ubuntu, for instance, I mean, all of these really professional kinds of Linux distributions, you can actually really, really see them being boxed up and sold on a shelf. And I mean I could see people going out and buying the Linux distribution and bringing it home and unboxing it and putting it on their computer and being perfectly happy. Of course, the only thing is that people don't do that sort of thing. They're lazy and they don't know anything about computers. And the other thing is, you know, they don't want to learn anything new. And the other thing is the whole MP3 thing and all that other nonsense, which again is kind of a pity. You know, you could see Linux being sold with the legal MP3 codec plugin thing from Fluendo. You know, I mean, just package that along with the thing, just like the other OSs do, and sell it in the store and make money off of it. And I realize that that kind of thing is just kind of imaginary. I mean, you really have to have the marketing, and you have to go crazy with getting it out there. But just separate from all that, like just looking at the presentation, looking at how nice it looks and professional it looks and all that other stuff, I can really see, I mean, there's no difference between Linux and Mac OS, since that seems to be the big golden chalice to which everyone aspires in terms of look and feel for some reason. But there's just no difference. Or even Windows 7, you know, I mean, not that I've actually seen it install or boot, but it's supposed to look really nice. So I imagine that it would look nice, you know, just as much as, for instance, OpenSUSE or Fedora, you know, with its nice little boot screen, or Ubuntu, Red Hat, or anything like that. It's just, they're really, really nicely put together, and definitely on par in look and feel to anything that you would purchase more or less in a store, even though most people don't purchase Mac OS or Windows separately in a store. So that notwithstanding, they did look nice. Just an observation. The other category of live CDs that I was using were the specialty distros. Well, actually one in particular, which was Backtrack, the security distro. This is fine, it's nice. It didn't actually boot into X. It couldn't initialize X for some reason, even though every other distribution I used could. But I didn't really need X, so it didn't really matter. So that was not a problem for me. For someone else, I guess that might be a problem, but it was also Backtrack 3, so, you know, if I'd tried Backtrack 4 on it, it might have been a different story. But no problems there. I mean, it's definitely a good distribution and overwhelmingly packed with everything that anyone would surely ever need for the security kinds of stuff. I didn't really know anything about what I was doing. I was just using it for a very specific purpose, which I could go into some other time, but not here, not now. And then, of course, there are other live CDs, specialty kinds of distros out there, but I didn't really try any of those because I simply needed Backtrack for a very specific purpose. But there were other things that, I mean, obviously there are other live CDs out there that one could try if one needed, for instance, the electrical engineering spin of Fedora, or the art spin of Fedora, or the Ubuntu Studio. Well, I guess that's not its own CD anymore, is it? But, you know, Dynabolic or all those other specialty distros, those are all very good for what you need them for. You know, I mean, they typically do what they're supposed to do fairly well. Those are obviously ones to check out if you have a specific need. Other ones like System Rescue CD or Clonezilla or whatever it's called. Lots of different ones out there that just kind of fill a niche, which is great. You know, it's really cool that such things exist, and they're very handy and very peculiar, I think, to Linux. You're just not going to find a live Mac OS image solely dedicated to security or to recovering data from hard drives or whatever. I mean, you'll see some such things, I think, from like Norton and companies like that. I think some of them do have things that you can boot into to try to, for instance, defrag your hard drive or something like that. But I mean, is that really the same thing? Not really. So yeah, I guess that's about all the thoughts on live CDs I had, and that went on longer than I really intended, but hopefully it was interesting. So moving right along. A couple of episodes ago, I talked about getting foreign or non-English language characters on your keyboard in Linux. If you'll recall, I did the whole multi-key, keycode 135 equals multi-key or something like that, in the .X modmap file in your home directory. And after doing that, I kind of got interested in xmodmap a little bit more. And I remembered that it used to be a big deal among, you know, I'd always see blog posts among hackers and stuff where they would always say, you know, the first thing I did was remap caps lock, control the caps lock, because people hate the caps lock key, except like one or two people. But most people in their right mind hate the caps lock key because it's just a key that you don't ever use, and yet it's right there on the home row, you know, it's on that magical row where your hands are supposed to rest, and there's this big, almost two key wide key just for caps lock, and you never use it. And even when I think, oh, I have to type a lot of things in capitals now, even in those cases, even with caps lock right there, my little finger always goes down to shift and hits that and just types with that pressed down. So I just never use it. It was silly to have it. And reaching all the way down to control all the time is a pain. Plus, one thing I've noticed about these PC keyboards that you people seem to love so much, and I guess I do too now, is that the control key is not in a standard location, which amazes me. It seems like a huge flaw. Not only do you guys have the F keys up at the top there in that one row, completely useless row of F keys, completely inaccessible, out of reach, you also have these control and FN key and a Windows key and a menu key thing that I've now reassigned to multi-key. And they seem to switch order. For instance, on my Toshiba, it goes Control FN Windows Alt, and on my Lenovo, it goes FN Control Windows Alt. So no matter what, depending on, you know, whichever computer I'm on, I'm always hitting the wrong key, thinking, okay, that's going to give me, you know, one thing, and it gives me something completely different. Well, that's just crazy. And that's not the only thing that seems to be a completely non-standard setup. There seems to be a thing about the whole home and page up and page down and end keys, which I'm not really that used to having anyway, because they weren't really a big deal on the Mac until fairly recently. But they seem to, you know, like on this Toshiba, they're over vertically on the right-hand side of the keyboard, and yet on my Lenovo, there are FN arrow key combinations, which I like a lot better, actually. And then the delete key, which I guess is a forward delete key, is over on the far right-hand upper corner of my Toshiba, and it's about three or four keys in on my Lenovo with, I think it's like a print screen over on the far right or something like that, you know? So really, really weird how there's not really a whole lot of standardization that I've seen so far in terms of keyboard layout, strangely enough. The answer, obviously, is Linux by way of xmodmap, or xmodmap by way of Linux. And to utilize this, it's quite simple. It's again, in your home directory with a .xmodmap file with a capital X. And right now, you probably already have keycode 135 equals multi underscore key. So the thing that you can do in that file, in addition to that, is you can first do a remove lock with a capital L on that lock. And those are two words, remove space lock with a capital L equals caps underscore lock. And the C and the L are both capital. And then you do the next line, or a space really, but next line works, remove control with a capital C equals control underscore L. Okay, so what we've done there is we've stripped away the powers of these keys as they currently exist. So we've stripped away caps lock from caps lock, most importantly. So now on the next line, you can do key code space 66, and of course you would want to verify that that's the key code for caps lock and for control and all that other good stuff. So you do want to do that. So key code space 66. Oh yeah, and to do that you of course issue the XEVZEV command. So XEV, and then you could even do, to make it simpler, pipe that to grep-i for key code. And that will show you just the key code line of whatever key you're pressing. So you can press the control key and the caps lock key and the other control key and get all the key codes for that and write it down. I wrote it down. So key code 66 equals, and that's key code space 66, equals Control_L. And that's control with a capital C, underscore L being a capital L. I don't know if all that stuff matters really, but I'm telling you to be complete. And the next line is key code 37 equals Control_L. And then key code space 105 equals Control_R. And then add control equals Control_L. Okay, so all of those, and I'll put a link, if I remember, to a blog post that I did with all this information in it. But all of those, basically, it takes the caps away from the caps lock, and then it assigns the control left keyboard event back to key code 66. So that's saying caps lock is no longer caps, and now it's no longer a toggle. It is now simply a control key. And then key code 37 is my left control key. So I assigned a Control_L to that. And then key code 105 is the control on the right, my control on the right. Again, you want to verify with yours. But key code 105 equals Control_R. And then you have to add control equals Control_L. So now you have three control keys. Now, I like it that way because that way I can use control commands from all over my keyboard. I especially use the caps lock key for my screen RC file, or with screen, because in my screen RC file I defined my escape code as control J, because control A was getting on my nerves. So control J is what I use for screen. So again, just on the home row, it's quite easy. If I'm typing something, hit caps lock J, and that is read as a control J, and then I'm in screen escape mode, and I can press the next key to do whatever I want, like create a new screen, or go to the next screen, or a previous screen, or whatever. So that works quite well. Now, I know that there is a way to make one of your caps lock keys, one of your control keys, a caps lock key, but I just didn't bother, because I literally have no need for the caps lock key. I will never need a caps lock key, so I just didn't bother. You are certainly welcome to do it differently yourself. It doesn't matter. But that's the way I did it. It works, and I find it a lot better. So some people have been asking me a little bit about MAMO and MIGO and Moblin, and the fact that they've merged. And I just wanted to say briefly, I guess, that I don't care. I realize that I do all my shows on my Nokia N800, and that is a MIMO platform. And for that reason, I can say that I'm a huge MIMO fan. You know, I love MIMO. It's my Linux distribution of choice for the portable platforms, I guess. Not really by choice, but that's because it's the device that I have. I mean, I've never tried any other platform per se, so I mean, it's kind of all I know. One thing that I really have had issues with MAMO and continue to have issues with it is the identity crisis it seems to have, or the split personality it seems to have. Like, half of its design seems to be optimized for the finger, a touch screen being poked at by a finger. So, meaning that the buttons are big, the little scroll bars are really fat, you know, everything is nice and big for the finger to hit. That makes sense to me. And then the other half of MAMO seems to think that actually it's a stylus-driven application or environment. And so all the scroll bars are really, really tiny and thin, and all the buttons are really small, and all the, you know, the close button is small, and all these other things. So that you're sitting there and you're using an application that's kind of finger-driven, and you love it, and you're all happy, and then suddenly you switch to something, and it was designed more for a stylus, and so you have to take out the stylus or start using your, you know, the very tip of your finger to get in there and try to get the thing without having to actually go to the trouble of getting your stylus, whatever. I dislike that, and I think that ideally MIGO, I guess, will decide that it's either got a switch that says stylus or finger, or it just says, okay, we're going to do all stylus, or we're going to do all finger. Hopefully it would be all finger. But yeah, that was an issue that I have with Mamo frequently. I mean, like, even on my, for instance, I mean, I haven't belabored the point enough yet. On my little Mamo recorder application that I use to record all these shows and all the interviews, it's the simplest interface you could ever imagine, okay? It's a whole big screen of, what, 320 by 480 or 260 by 480 or something like that, whatever the resolution of the Nokia screen is, right? It's like 3 physical inches by 2 physical inches or so. And all it needs to do is convey that it is recording and where the file is going to be saved at to and what format it's being recorded in. And then there needs to be a button to stop and to start recording and to play back and to save. And that's it. So, and then a lot of that's even optional. I mean, if you think about it, all that really needs to happen on screen at the moment is it recording right now, yes or no, and stop, start, and save. Simple, right? And yet, the buttons on this application are really, really small and obviously intended for a stylus because they're all sitting at the bottom of the screen and there's like 5 or 6 of them across and they're small and the text fields are very small and the drop down, the little pop-up menus are small. It boggles the mind because, I mean, of all applications to, and it's called Mamo Recorder, of all applications to optimize for a finger, that would be the one to do because it's just, there's nothing to it. It's such a simple application, a simple interface to design. The reason I guess I'm thinking about this is because Mego now exists. And the polar opposite of this was Moblin. Moblin was very, very clear on what it seems to need or what it is designed for. I mean, it is for a small screen platform. It wants to take up very little real estate. It feels like it should map everything to go full screen automatically, but I don't think, when I tried it, it didn't really have a very clear handle on that part of it so far. But everything on it, it really did feel, at least everything within the Moblin interface. And now once again, once you go into outside applications, it's a little bit different, which I think is a problem. But Moblin itself was very, very clear about, okay, we're going to be icon-driven, we're going to have sort of standard way of doing things, we're going to have big buttons and all that other good stuff. So it was very purposeful, which is cool. And I think that if Moblin and Mamo, well, now that they have gotten together and they've created Mego, I do hope that Mego will be as clear as Moblin was, but as functional as Mamo was. That would be what I would hope would come out of all this. And for anyone who doesn't like any of those things, there is Meh, which is great as well. So, yeah, lots of good choices there, actually. Nokia, are they inspiring a whole lot of confidence and kind of making it known that their platform is alive and healthy and fully supported? Not really. You know, I would probably think twice before going out and buying, like, an N900 or whatever, because it does feel a little bit haphazard. But having said that, I think it's about as raw a GNU Linux system as you're going to get on a mobile platform right now, outside of Mer. Mer strikes me as a very, very pure, well, it is, I mean, it's a very nice and pure sort of version of GNU Linux. You create a user account, which is so fantastic, because that's what I want. I don't know why people think that just because it's a mobile platform, you don't want to have user accounts and protect your data or be able to lock it from, or be able to pass it to a friend, but switch over to a different account, you know, things like that. I don't understand why they're trying to enforce this kind of, oh, you're a single user now thing. Mer doesn't try to do that, which is really fantastic. So I'm going to keep checking back with Mer, because I think that would be my preferred platform. But outside of that, as opposed to going to something else that has like some kind of Java front end over it or a Java layer on top of it or is only a web-based thing, you know, I'm not interested in all that so much. I would rather just go with what works, which is GNU Linux, and just have that and go with that. So if Mego manages to approximate a very clearly defined finger touch screen interface that is like Mer, that is basically just GNU Linux for you on a mobile platform, I'd be cool with that. Sounds like it's time for a coffee break. Let's go take one, get some coffee, because I got a lot more to talk about. So grab some coffee, come back, and we'll continue the show. So Gitorious is a site. You may have heard of like GitHub, things like that. These are centralized hubs, servers. These are servers that have an implementation of Git on them so that people can then use that as their remote centralized Git repository. This means that if you are working on a project and you want to collaborate with other people, or you just need kind of a geeky cloud, then you can sign up with one of these servers and host your project on their server, which is pretty cool. I was looking at GitHub, but it looked like they didn't have a completely free software stack. It looked like there were some proprietary elements to it, which is fine for me, really, but I figured there was probably something out there that was completely free. And it just seems to make sense if you're going to be doing a public service like this and you're going to be doing Git, which is kind of a very popular free software content management system. Why not have a completely free stack underneath? So I hunted a little bit further, and I found this place called Gitorious, which is actually really, really nice. And it's home to a lot of popular and well-known projects, and certainly some projects that I really, really like, such as Qt, for instance. So seeing some of these names on the Gitorious site and seeing the commits and everything like that, kind of cool. So I did an HPR episode on Git a long time ago, and it was just very basic user kinds of stuff, and because that's all I was doing with it at the time, and I was really, really, really using it in a very, very basic way. Now recently at the job that I have during the week, I use Git actually quite a lot, on a daily basis, pretty much, and the difference also is that it's a Git implementation where there are actually other people committing, which is completely new to me, really. The first thing I was using Git for didn't even have commit access to, or Git commit permissions. But I decided to set up Gitorious and use it for actually Slacker Media and kind of working on a more full and richer version of all the information on the Slacker Media site. So I decided to use Gitorious to host that, and so I signed up with them, and so obviously now I had commit access to this, and I was going along fine. You know, I'd work on it on one computer, and then on another computer, and then on another computer. Doesn't matter. I had Git on them. It was perfectly sunk. No problems. Okay, that's with one person working on something. It's completely different when you start to have 30 different people all committing back to this one Git thing, and their different branches, and all that other stuff. Really, really exciting stuff. Really interesting, and it's just made me really fall in love with Git. So I can highly recommend Git for at least from an end-user perspective, because, again, I'm not really committing things like code and stuff, but from what I understand, the Linux kernel uses Git, so it's probably going to be okay. It seems to be very popular, and from what I can tell, not that I have a whole lot of experience with other content management services, except for basic checking out of the latest source code of, I don't know, Blender or something, I don't really have that much of comparison, but I do like it. I do like Git. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about going out and getting a Gitorious account and setting up a local Git repository and starting the whole Git process. And I think it's a good thing to do. I mean, I wouldn't do it just for kicks necessarily, but it's a really cool way. I mean, if you're using Dropbox right now for documents and stuff like that, you might want to look into getting a Git repository. Not on Gitorious necessarily, because I believe that's a public committing kind of site. You commit and the world will see what you've just committed, so probably not something to do with your private information and stuff like that. But if you're just doing it for a project or something like that and you don't care, or you want to hunt down another service where maybe there is more privacy involved, you know, where you can close it off or something, then you could try that as well, I guess. But just for me, it's for a project, and it could potentially be an open source project where other people could look at it and contribute to it. It wouldn't really matter. I mean, that's not the case, but it could happen. And so it's working quite well for me. So this is basically how to start, and I think learning this kind of stuff is handy because you never know when you are going to get involved with a project or a job where they are using Git in the real world, and having a little bit of knowledge about how to check things out and push things back, and the difference between committing, well, the need to put something on your, to stash something away before a commit, and just stuff like that. That's really kind of good information to have. And you can't really get that information unless you've used Git. So the first step would obviously be to get an account at gitorious.org. Like I say, it's a free software stack from top to bottom, so it's not a bad place to be a member of if you're going to be using Git for yourself. Once you open up an account there, you need to create a project listing for yourself, or for your project. And you also need to set up your SSH keys so that when you're away, you know, you're on some other computer somewhere, you can access that Git repository. The way to do that would be, well, if you've already got an SSH key on your machine, then that is located in /home/username/.ssh/id_rsa.pub, usually, unless you've specifically changed that yourself. But that's where it will be. What you can do is, if you don't have that, then you can just generate a key, and that would be ssh-keygen, K-E-Y-G-E-N, and that will generate literally a key, and it asks you a couple of questions, but afterwards it dumps out a key for you. Now after that you can do a less on /home/username/.ssh/id_rsa.pub, and then you can select the contents of that file, copy them, and then you want to paste them into the Gitorious dashboard, your little dashboard that Gitorious gives you, under the SSH key access window or pane, whatever. There is a pretty clear place where you paste this key. So now they know the key, and you know the key, and you've got the key, and now you can push things to your Git repository, well, once you've set one up, without a problem. Okay, so now you need to identify your local Git identity. This is the identity that's going to kind of show up as the maintainer, and it's going to have an email address associated with it and all that other good stuff. So this is going to be fairly public-facing is what I'm trying to say, or at least as public as your Git repository is, which again, I think on Gitorious it is, at least by default, it's fairly public-facing. I don't know if they have options to close it off and make it less open source or whatever, but that is the default for sure. So the command to do this is git config, that's git space config, --global user.name, and then the username that you want to use in quotes. So I've got, let's say, quote, not clat2, end quote. And that establishes within a .git file, I think, the global username. Now you want to do also a git config --global user.email, and then quote, or space, quote, clat2@whatever.org, close quote. Now you've got a name and an email set up, and you're all configured now to use Gitorious. So if you had a Git repository on your local machine, then you'd be ready to use Gitorious. However, you probably don't have a Git repository yet. I didn't. And my experience with this kind of thing had been more along the lines of like web design and stuff like that, where maybe you have a local copy of everything on the website, and then you just take that whole folder and you upload it to the server, and then suddenly it's online for everyone to see. And it's all very self-contained, and it's got its own little internal path going on and stuff like that. It's not completely different on Git, but there are some extra steps that you have to take in order to establish something as the all-important Git project directory. So the first thing we want to do is create a directory, and we'll make this our Git directory, or this project's Git directory. So in my case, it was literally /dir/slacker-media. Okay, that's my directory. And then let's say I go into Slacker Media and I copy, or I establish a file. Let's just call it index.html, and I start typing some text in there. So now I've got a Slacker Media directory, and I've got one index file, one file in there that is an index.html. But it could be anything. It could be random module.c or randomness.c++, whatever. It can be any kind of file that you want. I'm using primarily just actually plain text files for Slacker Media. So now you've got your local repository that you're going to be working on all your stuff within, and you need to just tell Git that that's what this is, that this is a Git you need to earmark this as a Git repository. So the way to do that would be you see where you are, so PWD, obviously. So you should be inside the Slacker Media folder. If you're not, go inside of there just to make this easier. And then you want to initialize. So you want to git init. It will return to you that, yes, it has initialized an empty Git repository in /home/username/slackermedia/.get. So now this folder has been earmarked as a Git location. It's got one file in it, and it is a very dedicated folder to whatever project you're working on that you're going to be syncing back and forth to your big Git repository off in the sky. So really, at this point, you're ready to start committing and pushing the stuff up to that server. So maybe you work a little bit more on the files, maybe not, who knows, depends. The point is that, for instance, if you did a Git status right now, you'd see that there was nothing to update on the Git server because it's empty up there. And it will probably tell you, it should tell you, that it's noticing that there's a file that exists in your current Git folder, but there doesn't seem to be any record of the fact that it exists. So what you need to do is add that file to Git, essentially. So it's called, or the command is git space add space, for instance, index.html. Okay, now Git is starting to track that file. It's added a little earmark, little tag to that file that says, okay, I'm going to follow you around and see if you ever change from your current state. So now you've got some sort of standard Git stuff that you would do, for instance, git commit. So git space commit will now look at the files that have changed. In this case, it is index.html because you've added it to its little tracker or whatever. It sees that it's changed or that it's never been committed at all, and so it gives you it's going to open up in your default text editor a place where you can enter notes about why you're committing this file. So typically on the first line I just explain why I am committing the file, like if it's I corrected some bugs or I added a new section on video-meta or whatever. And then I put my name so that I know who committed it. I realize that always going to be me committing, but I figured it was best practices to start that kind of thing. Okay, so save that file, you know, however you do it, like whether it's Control-O, Control-X in Nano or Control-X, S in Emacs and Control X, Control C, close it, :WQ in Vim. However you do that, make that happen, and now you're returned to the command line. And so the Git files have been marked for going live. They haven't gone live yet, but they've been marked for going live. And so now what you need to do is do a git remote add origin. So that is git space remote space add space origin space git at gitorious.org /slackermedia/slackermedia. So, or slackermedia.git, or whatever Gitorious has given you for the address that you push to. And it will tell you that in your little dashboard on Gitorious. It will tell you, make your commit here. So it's going to be very clear on the subject. And so all you do is a git remote add origin, and then paste in the address that they give you, essentially, so that you can actually make commits to your repository. So now you've told Git where it's going to be pushing the changes to. You've already committed those changes, so what you really need to do at this point is issue the actual push command. And this is the big deal. This is the big command that actually copies the bits from your computer up there to the cloud and makes the changes to the file. So obviously before you do this, I like to issue a git status again just to make sure that I know what's about to happen, and it'll tell you, yeah, you've got like one file ready for committing and so on and so forth. Here's the comment that you wrote down for it and all this other good stuff. So you can see with your own eyes that's what you're about to push up to the cloud. And then you simply type in git space push space origin space master. And that takes an assessment of the different changes that it needs to do, and it syncs with Gitorious to the address that you specified, and that's it. It gives you a confirmation at some point, probably pretty quickly if it's a small file like it usually is in my case, and that's it. Now you're sunk. So now you can go to some other computer and establish a Git account, or not a Git account, but a Git user there, the same way that we did over here on this computer, and then you can do a Git pull. you know, just make a new directory, like make dir or slacker media or something like that, and then do git pull, and then the pull address, which would be git@gatorius.org:whatever, and that will pull everything from your Gatorius account down to your computer, and now you have local copies of those things, and you can start changing those there as well. So that's quite nice. It really adds a lot of flexibility, at least for me, because I can be at work and I can work on something. I can go home and work on something. I can go out to a cafe with my EEE PC and work on something. And as long as I am plugged into the net at some point before, you know, at some point, I can always get the most recent changes to Slacker Media, pull them down to my computer, my local computer, with git pull or git fetch and git rebase, depending on what I need to do, and continue to work. And then when I'm finished, git push to the address, and all the changes are updated. So it's really quite nice. It's kind of a geekier cloud than the usual solution, I guess. But I think it's better in the long run. Not really because it's just so important that I use Git. I mean, it's not my projects obviously are not complex enough to warrant that, really. But in terms of learning something new and having the knowledge about Git combined with a little bit of real-world knowledge, because that's always important. You can always say, oh yeah, I've used Git, which I had. I'd used Git, but the minute you start using it with 30 other people, and they're all on different branches, and they're committing to both the development branch and to the unstable branch, the stable and the unstable branches, and all that other good stuff, things become a little bit more complex, and certainly at least I get a little bit more nervous about committing things and pushing things, because you don't really want to screw up the whole branch and be responsible for having done that. So, I mean, not that it can't be undone, of course, but it is a different, it's a completely different feel to the process. So getting used to it now, to me, seems like a good idea. And like I say, it's also quite convenient, because I've tried other things. I've tried Dropbox, I've tried USB keys, I've tried emailing myself the changes and all this other different stuff, and it just boils down to being a lot of work for yourself, and also having to really think about, okay, now is this really the latest change, or is this the second to latest change, or is this newer, or did I make a change on this computer, forget to put it on my USB key, and then made more changes at work? You know, all these different things kind of go into trying to synchronize files from different locations, and it's very complex. Git is designed to solve that problem, so why not use it? And that's how you use it. Gatorius, Git, terminal, stuff. Have fun. Just so I don't really fall behind, and I realize that it's getting down to the wire right now in terms of going on too long and stuff like that, but I don't want to get too far behind on listener feedback, or else I have to, you know, figure out how to manage all the old listener feedback and stuff, and I don't really love doing that. So one of the emails that I got from well, I mean, I've got lots of email, and unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to completely cover it all, as usual. So I always try to respond to people as soon as possible, and if for some reason I fail to do so, I do apologize, but I don't think I've failed to get back to anyone yet, so I don't think I have to apologize. But if I do not get back to you, it is not intentional. And if I'm not reading your email on the show, it's not because I don't like you, it is simply because I've either forgotten that you've emailed me and it's like somewhere in my inbox. I mean, not forgotten, but forgotten to read it on the show, you know? Or I don't want to just read everything I get. Not that I get that much email, but I get enough. So anyway, the point being that I did get some email, and one of them that comes to mind immediately is from a guy named Jim, and he was asking me about the Mutt issue, and he was saying, why did I choose to use the inbox message format rather than the mail dir format? Maildir I have heard of, and that is M-A-I-L-D-I-R, Maildir. And I've heard of this. I didn't really know exactly what it was, but apparently it's every message is a separate file in separate folders arranged by, he says subject, and I don't really understand who defines the subject. But this sounds like a dream to me. I mean, this is great. It's a level of abstraction taken away, you know? It's like, yes, all the text files in their own little files, rather than being a gigabyte-sized text file called inbox, which surely when you get that many things going on, you're just kind of inviting corruption and things like that. So it seems like Maildir would be a great solution. And he asks me why I didn't use it. And the answer is because when I pulled all my mail from one server, I did it in such a way, completely not knowing what I was doing, but I did it in such a way that it came down as a big inbox format, or an inbox-like format, as I found out later, because like I say on the last episode, it's actually not the right inbox format, so I had to convert it with Formail. It was basically just out of ignorance. Yes, I got an inbox file, and I think I read somewhere that there's probably some programs to parse the inbox thing and send them out as separate text files, so I might look into that eventually. Not anytime soon, though. You know, one step at a time, basically, but I might do that. So Maildir sounds really nice, so if you ever see that as an option, you might want to give that a shot. Jim also says that he uses, that he had once used FetchMail and ProcMail to get the mail and to parse it or whatever, but now he uses Mutt's built-in SMTP and IMAP options. This seems to be sort of an unclear topic for me, because I've heard about Mutt having this ability, and yet I also seem to be hearing that it's not officially in Mutt, and that Mutt actually is in a state of questionable development, and that there are new versions, but they're not real versions, or something like that, or they need to be patched, or something. It seems like there's a lot of different stuff going on with Mutt from a lot of different sources. At least that seems to be my cursory overview of it, and I'm not really too sure about it, so don't take that as the actual truth. I'm just saying my impression is that there's no central authoritative place saying this is the Mutt you always hear about, because it seems like a lot of people have Mutt patched and different versions of it and all this other stuff. So what patch I'm supposed to apply, and whether certain things are actually in all versions of Mutt or not. So I'm going to just, again, one step at a time, I'm looking into Mutt more. I'm going to be making my Mutt RC file a little bit more robust, because right now I don't even have any GPG going on there, which I really don't like. So it's going to be developed, and right now I'm going to continue to use FetchMail and ProcMail, simply because, and I don't love FetchMail because of the fact that you have to have your password just kind of hanging out there in your home folder. I'm going to keep using it because I do think that they're common enough that I should continue to use them so that I know a little bit more about them. And if I just walk away from them now, I don't feel like I'm going to ever be able to say, oh yeah, FetchMail and ProcMail, yeah, well, I know all about those. So, good suggestions, Jim, and I'm going to be looking more into them both, actually. And Jim also offered to send me the couple of lines in his MuttRC file to do the whole SMTP and IMAP thing, so I will probably be taking him up on that offer at some point, but later. Michael wrote me about Rockbox, and Rockbox, of course, is Rockbox, which I'm sure that you know about this this software project, if you're listening to this show. But, if you don't, go to rockbox.org. It's new firmware for your audio player. Rockbox is great. It's fantastic. Apparently they've built in, or they've added a software-based compressor and limiter into the recent builds of Rockbox, which is interesting. This should, in theory, really optimize a lot of the audio that you're hearing. Now, personally, me, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I'll just put them into a folder on Rockbox, and I'll go to the top of the folder and press play, and it plays through them all. Not all podcasters know the magical wonders of normalize and compression and limiters and levelers and all these other things, and so you have someone speaking at you really, really loud, and then you've got someone that you can barely hear, and then you've got someone who has the music really, really loud, but their voice only sort of medium. Point is, what I do before I put all of my you know, I do the Mash Potter script, and then I have all those things go into a folder, and then I go in with normalize, the command line tool, and just run normalize on all of the episodes, and that completely makes them all very, very optimized and more or less at the same level. I do it fairly harshly, and I don't have a whole lot of consideration for music and stuff like that, but this is because most of the podcasts I listen to, with the notable exception of Linux and the Ham Shack and Juiced Penguin, both of which are very, very mindful, obviously, of the music that they play. So I don't want to screw those up, so I don't normalize those two, but all the other ones I do, and it really works really nicely, and Ken Fallon somewhere on his computer probably has some fancy script that is doing that automagically, so cool, and I do it manually right now, but it does work, and it gets everything at more or less the same level, so that's I like that. Thoth wrote me. Thoth is a guy who's really into multimedia and stuff like that, and he and I have been talking about the whole Blender as the video editor thing for a while. Kind of cool. But he was in the Freenode channel, Slacker Media, the other day, and apparently he was also an open source musician channel, which of course is another fine podcast. I guess I should say something cool like shout-outs to Guitar Man or something like that. So, yeah, open source musician, and he was in Slacker Media, which is the development and support channel of Slacker Media, so don't go there to chat. And he was trying to figure out how to compile and install, I want to say AmSynth, it could have been something else, but he was having some issues. No, it might have been Alsa Synth. I forget exactly which one it was, but it was some kind of synth that he was installing on Slackware, he was having some problems with it. I guess he got it figured out eventually, not through me, because he started to ignore me rudely after a while, but probably because I didn't have any answers. But, you know, it worked out really nicely, and I think I'm going to ask him for his, he sent me a link with all the notes about how to get it working and stuff. So yeah, that's cool and much appreciated. And he asked me for my real-time kernel config file, which I forgot to send him, so I'm going to do that after the recording of the show, actually. Sorry, Thoth. And so Slacker Media is coming along. It's really kind of a great way to build up a multimedia distribution for yourself, really. It's been working really, really well for me. I mean, I'm not going to say it's got no glitches, because I think multimedia in general has glitches. I mean, I record with a lot of different people, and it's just on a lot of different platforms. I honestly do not believe, and this is from my heart of hearts, I don't believe that any of the platforms out there have a complete multimedia like solution, and I don't think it's the platform. I think it's just the applications and the demands that the users put upon them. I mean, applications, as we know, have bugs. I mean, that's just something that applications have, and we're asking them to create and generate all this new media for ourselves, and then we want to translate them or transcode them or trans-something them, and then we want to send them somewhere, and then we want to import them into another application, and we want them to do something else and add it to them. I mean, we ask a lot of these things, and not being a programmer, I really don't know if that's complex or not, but I imagine it is, because it seems to be something prone to error. So, having said that, multimedia content creation is a tough racket, and I'm not going to say that any platform has it on a lockdown quite yet. But of all the distributions I've really produced multimedia on, I will say hands down that Slackware has been the one that has treated me the absolute best. I mean, in terms of stability, ease of use, and configurability, that's where it's at right there, Slackware. And with that, I think I'm going to end the show. I know I said I was going to talk a little bit about some other things, but I'm afraid I'm going on too long. So let's just end the show now, and I'll get to other stuff on other episodes. Thank you, everyone, for writing in. Thank you, even everyone else, for listening. And it's really cool. I've been getting a lot of some feedback from people I'd never actually heard from before, so that was kind of cool. You know, like Jim, I didn't know Jim existed, but he wrote me to tell me about the Mutt stuff, so it's really cool. Definitely don't hesitate to email if you have comments or questions or suggestions or anything like that. Thanks for listening, and this has been episode 9 of season 5. If you need to contact me at all, it's clat2@member.fsf.org. You can find me in Freenode as well as notclat2. You can go to the website at clat2.hackerpublicradio.org. And I think that's about it, really, so... Oh yeah, Jabber. I'm not clat2@jabber.org. So any one of those methods, if you need to contact me, feel free to do so. And I'll also be at Southeast Linux Fest and at FOSCON. So find me there in person. I'm the one with blue hair, so you kind of can't miss me. So I will see you there if you're there.
You're almost there.